against Dover District Council. And this examined the duty to give reasons for granting planning permission. Legislation which previously imposed such a duty had been repealed some years ago. There remained a statutory duty to give reasons for refusing planning permission, but the legislation had been amended to get rid of the duty in circumstances where permission was being granted. And the court said that although the common law would not supply a duty to give reasons in all cases where planning permission is granted, because there are hundreds of thousands of grants of planning permission every year, it should do so. It should impose a duty as at the common law in certain specific circumstances. And this is the approach that will be followed now in all public law contexts. And what it essentially requires is an examination of the circumstances to ascertain whether fairness in that particular instance requires reasons to be given for a decision. And a principal justification for imposing a duty to give reasons is the need to reveal whether there's been an error in the courts, in the decision itself, because you can only appreciate whether there's been an error as to whether all the relevant factors have been taken into account if you understand the basis upon which the decision has been reached. So in that way, the duty to give reasons is intimately connected with ensuring an effective right to challenge a decision by way of judicial review. And what Lord Carnwath said in the Dover case at paragraph 54 is that fairness provides the link between the common law duty to give reasons for an administrative decision and the right of the individual affected to bring proceedings to challenge the legality of that decision. And this is another consequence of the requirement that justice must be seen to be done. Lastly, before we turn to Julia, to look at rationality and proportionality, I just want to touch upon the impact of the Human Rights Act on fairness challenges. The most obvious point to make is the incorporation of Article 6, which is the right to a fair trial. And this has developed in Strasbourg jurisprudence in tandem with the common law requirement of procedural fairness. And it's probably fair to say that it's had most of its influence in the field of criminal law. However, it also applies to the determination of civil rights and obligations, and thus has had some effect, at least, on administrative decision making. There have been occasions where UK legislation has been read down under Section 3 of the HRA in order to avoid a breach of Article 6, or where subordinate legislation or executive acts have been quashed. One example, there are a series of cases in the late noughties concerning the imposition of control orders on terror suspects where Article 6 was engaged in the court's consideration of those cases. And a very recent case to keep an eye on is QX against the Secretary of State for the Home Department. This is a judgment from last month. The claimant is a suspected Al-Qaeda affiliate who is seeking a review of reporting obligations imposed on him as a condition of his return to the UK following a temporary exclusion from the country. And the court had a preliminary issue hearing last month and determined that Article 6 of the convention is engaged by such a review, and whether the article is breached will now be the subject of a further hearing. So that's something to keep an eye on for those interested in the development of Article 6 in the administrative civil context rather than just in the criminal context. So with that, I hope that that's a useful introduction to the grounds of illegality and procedural unfairness. And I'll now hand over to Julia to take you from there. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Matt. Can everybody see and hear me? Please speak up in the chat box if you can't. I'm assuming you can. I can't see myself, but that's very good. Welcome to my salubrious spare room. I'm going to talk to you about rationality and proportionality. And just for your note, you've got this covered in paragraph 36 to 44 of the PLP's delegate pack. So let me start with Wednesbury, and there are various formulations of Wednesbury. The classic formulation is a decision that's so unreasonable that no reasonable decision maker could have come to it. Now, I act for both the government and for claimants, and of course, I've never seen a decision like that. often they won't get to court, but it's a difficult ground to make out, as the slide says. But I'm going to qualify that in a moment. But that's the test, and there are various formulations of it. Another formulation is a decision which elicits the explanation, my goodness, that's certainly wrong. But again, these are all very loose concepts and difficult to pin down. And as you all have seen, it's a very almost vague and open-ended concept. And I'm just going to read you a passage from De Smith, which is De Smith Judicial Review, and it says this: given the variety of unacceptable decisions, there's probably merit in retaining a residual pigeonhole of decisions which are simply not reasonable. However, there's also merit in the articulation of more certain standards, principles and criteria in order to guide the behaviour of officials, affected persons and their advisers. And what De Smith does is in fact say, we've looked at all of the cases on rationality and actually we can break them down into various categories. Is this really a category of its own very much anymore? So coming back to the slide, that it's a difficult ground for claimants to make out, try telling that to the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. In a case, a judgment which was published yesterday about universal credit. Now that's a case about the rules for calculating universal credit for calculating earned income to work out how much universal credit could get. And the difficulty was that for people who were paid at the end of the month, they would have different payment dates and this would affect the universal credit. So one month they might get nothing or they would get a lower amount, and then another month they would get a much higher amount. And that wasn't just awkward for them personally in terms of organising their finances. It had real knock-on implications, which are discussed in the judgment. So that was the issue that faced the Court of Appeal, and it came to the Court of Appeal on appeal from the Secretary of State because the Divisional Court had decided it based on interpretation of the legislation. So it hadn't decided that the legislation was irrational. And the government appealed on the interpretation of the legislation. But when it appealed, the claimants cross-appealed and argued that if they lost on interpretation of the legislation, then the legislation was irrational. Now, again, a difficult ground for claimants to make out, but this is well worth reading. Let me read from paragraph 107 of the judgment of Lady Justice Rose. The threshold for establishing irrationality is very high, but it is not insuperable. This case is, in my judgment, one of the rare instances where the Secretary of State's refusal to put in place a solution to this very specific problem is so irrational that I have concluded that the threshold is met, because no reasonable Secretary of State would have struck the balance in that way. So that's a great case to see the test in action, to see some specific facts where the Court of Appeal has decided that actually the test of rationality was met. And then contrast that with a case in which I've acted recently for the government, which is a case about the legality of special rules which apply to abortion during COVID-19. And again, just to contrast, I'm going to read you a couple of passages from the judgment just to see how the court approaches issues like this. So this is a judgment of Lord Justice Singh and Mr. Justice Chamberlain. And what the court says right at the beginning of its judgment is, The issue of abortion raises questions of ethics and social policy on which many people have strongly held views, which are sometimes diametrically opposed and irreconcilable. Those questions are not for the courts to determine. The role of this court, as always, in judicial review proceedings is to determine the lawfulness of the Secretary of State's decision, nothing else. And then when it comes to rationality, what the court says is this ground is unarguable. It's plainly open to a reasonable Secretary of State to conclude that women who otherwise needed lawful and properly regulated abortion services would not be able to access them in the current emergency without this approval being made. A rational minister was plainly entitled to act on the basis of advice, even if others sincerely disagree with it. So that's just to give you two examples of cases, recent cases, where the courts have been looking at rationality. It's a very short slide, so sorry that you're just going to hear my voice without the relief of a slide to look at, but I just want to make three points about irrationality. That the first is to say, well, why is the threshold so high? And fundamentally, the reason for that is the boundary between the government, the executive on the one hand, and the courts on the other. The second point to make is, even within the Wensbury standard, you can have a different intensity of review. And that is explained. I'm just going to, if I can find it, read you a passage from a judgment of Mr. Justice Green, as he then was, in a case called Justice for Health and Secretary of State for Health. And again, very happy to pass on any of these references if you would like them. Please feel free to get in touch. What Mr. Justice Green said in that case is, in determining whether a decision maker has acted irrationally, the intensity of the scrutiny to be applied by a court is context sensitive. So even within this standard, it's context sensitive. There's a different scale of intensity of review. Case law, this I'm now reading from Mr. Justice Green's judgment, case law tends to suggest that the following considerations will tend to broaden the scope of the margin of appreciation. Where the decision maker is taking a decision in the health field with the objective of improving patient care, where the decision adopted is prospective and precautionary, and where the decision maker has indicated a willingness and intention to review the policy as it unfolds to ensure that it is in fact working adequately and to review and modify it to address emerging problems. So those are areas where the court will be particularly hands-off. So that's the second point. And the third point is this, that in this area, as in any area of public law, it is impossible to draw neat lines because all of these grounds tend to merge into one another, or at least several of them do. And that comes out of the Court of Appeal case that I mentioned, where the court discusses there the Padfield ground that Matt was telling you about earlier. And basically, in that case, there was a bit of discussion about, well, is this really a rationality argument, or is it really an argument that the Secretary of State has acted ultra vires in the sense of acting contrary to the objects of the Act? And the court says, well, this is actually a rationality argument. But again, I'm just going to read you what Lord Justice Underhill had to say about that, because it sets it out far better than I could. He says, I'm inclined to agree with Lady Justice Rose that the relevant form of unlawfulness is best characterised as irrationality, though I also agree that it has echoes of the Padfield principle. But ultimately, these various characterisations are simply aspects of the fundamental question of whether Parliament can have intended the rulemaking power to be exercised in a way which produces so arbitrary and harmful an impact on the respondents. I do not believe that it can. So you see there the scope for overlap between all of these different grounds. And you will also see that different judges, different textbooks analyse in different ways. So you will sometimes see a failure to take matters properly into account as part of an irrationality challenge, for example. So that's a sort of canter through irrationality. I just wanted to give three practical tips if you're running a rationality point. And the first is, you're unlikely to want to lead with this, but it's good to include if you've got a decent case on it. The second point is, as far as you can in the grounds that lead to it, be very specific, so that you're not just lumping everything into one basket. You're actually clear about what your grounds are. And I've seen judges get very frustrated when they don't have clear grounds and can move from one to the other. And it's difficult, as I say, because they tend to merge. But insofar as you can, my practical tip is, be clear about the discrete grounds. And the third tip I'd have in relation to rationality, as far as you can, make it punchy when you're describing what the irrationality is. And I've run a rationality argument in a case recently for a claimant, and the case has been conceded. And again, it's good to be able to say, look, this is obviously so wrong because blah, blah, blah. So those are my practical tips on rationality, and we'll have questions later, but that's basically a canter through irrationality as a ground. And then moving on to proportionality, your pack at paragraphs 41 to 44 focuses on the impact of the Human Rights Act, and Matt's very helpfully talked about that already, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But something to mention to you first is that there's a very interesting ongoing debate about whether proportionality could actually be a ground for review in domestic law. And fundamentally, the courts have shied from that because it involves the court getting into the merits when actually that's for government. But there are a few cases on this, and I won't mention all of them, but there's some dicta of Lord Mance in a couple of cases which said, well, we actually should be having proportionality as a ground, and it's sometimes advanced by claimants. But fundamentally, the position at the moment is that it's not a domestic ground of review. But I'm just going to read you what Lord Carnworth had to say in a case called Youssef, which is 2016 appeal cases 1457 at paragraph 55. And I hope you don't think I'm cheating by reading out lots of judges, but they can express things far better than I ever could. So what Lord Carnworth says is, and that's a case called Kayu, this court had occasion to consider arguments in the light of Kennedy and Pham that this court should authorise a general move from the traditional judicial review test to one of proportionality. Lord Neuberger thought that the implications could be wide-ranging and profound, and for that reason would require consideration by an enlarged court. There was no dissent from that view in the other judgments. And then he goes on to say this: this is a subject which continues to attract intense academic debate. And then he gives a quote. It's to be hoped that an opportunity can be found in the near future for an authoritative review in this court of the judicial and academic learning on the issue, including relevant comparative material from other common law jurisdictions. Such a review might aim for rather more structured guidance for the lower courts and such imprecise concepts as anxious scrutiny and sliding scales. And anxious scrutiny and sliding scales, I'm sure you know, are terms which are used in relation to proportionality review more generally. So somebody had just asked what was my first practical tip. What I said was, in terms of rationality, unlikely to lead with it. But if you've got a genuine good reason for advancing a rationality ground, it's good to include it. So back to proportionality, coming back then to the ECHR, your PAC points out, to justify an interference with a qualified convention right, a state's required to demonstrate that the interference is authorised by domestic law for the purpose of pursuing a legitimate aim and is proportionate. Let's take Article 8, because that this is one of the most frequently litigated articles. It provides everyone has the right to respect for his private and family life, his home and his correspondence. And then Article 8, 2, there should be no interference by a public authority with the exercise of this right, except such as in accordance with the law and is necessary in a democratic society in the interests of national security, public safety, or the economic well-being of the country, for the prevention of disorder or crime, for the protection of health or morals, or for the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. So in an immigration case called RASGAR, which is 2004 UK HL 11, the House of Lords spells out five questions that need to be answered. So one, is Article 8 engaged? Two, is there an interference? Three, is such interference in accordance with the law? Four, is it necessary in the interest of one of those matters that I just read out? And then five, is it proportionate to the legitimate public aim? So as your PAC points out, when you get onto justification, it's for the public authority to make out its justification. And when you're in Wednesbury, it's the other way around. The claimant's doing all of the work. And really, there needs to be evidence about that. And again, as your PAC points out, what it requires is a balancing exercise between the general interests of the community on the one hand, and the legitimate interests of the state, and on the other, the protection of the individual's rights and interests. So if anybody's interested in seeing the Court of Appeal grapple with Article 8 in two recent cases this year, it's worth having a look first at a case called Elan Kane, which is 2020 EWCA Civ 363, and another case called McConnell, which is 2020 EWCA Civ 539. Elan Kane is a case about whether it's unlawful not to permit somebody to have X in the gender field in a passport. And there was a debate in that case about whether or not Article 8 was engaged, and the court said absolutely Article 8 is engaged, but on the fact of that case there was no interference with Article 8 rights. And again, it's interesting just to have a look at, to see how the court grapples with these issues in practice. And then in McConnell, the question as it was captured by the Court of Appeal is, can a transgender man be registered as the father on the birth certificate of a child to whom he's given birth? So really difficult, sensitive questions that you have the court grappling here with Article 8 and proportionality. And in McConnell, there's two interesting features which come out of it for the purposes of today's talk. The first is that the Lord Chief Justice explains that the court isn't concerned with process or reasons when it's dealing with a proportionality challenge. So contrast that with rationality, where the Secretary of State will always say, well, this turns on the material in front of the Secretary of State at the time. What the court is doing when it's looking at ECHR justification is it's looking at the matter now on the basis of the evidence now, and that's explained at paragraph 42 of the judgment. And then there's a very interesting discussion about proportionality and also the margin of appreciation given to Parliament and why that is. And you'll find that at paragraphs 80 to 82 of the judgment. The court talks there about the institutional competence between the courts and Parliament, and also the democratic process. And the conclusion that the court reaches in both of those cases is that the claimant lost. So in McConnell, the court said that the legislative scheme required the claimant to be registered as the mother, and that wasn't contrary to Article 8. So those are two if you're interested in proportionality, it's worth having a look at those cases. And then the final point to make, again, not on your slide, but if your case has an EU element to it, then there is also EU proportionality to take into account. And the lead case on EU proportionality is a case called Lumsden, in the case, which is 2016, appeal cases 697. And a case where I acted recently in the Supreme Court called Gubaladze, where the government lost on proportionality in the upper tribunal and in the Court of Appeal, as I recall, and in the Supreme Court. And that's an interesting case as well on EU proportionality. And that's 2019 appeal cases 885. But again, you need to be able to find an EU aspect to your case to be able to raise EU proportionality. And I won't talk about that in any detail, but essentially EU proportionality is very context specific. So I think that was everything I wanted to cover on proportionality. I think that covers what's in your pack and more generally. And happily, I finished just in time for a break. I'm sure you're all very relieved about that.
Hi there, everyone. We'll take a 5-minute break before we take questions, if that's all right. I just want to praise both our speakers, Matt and Julia, for extremely clear delivery, which is incredibly important with this online stuff. It's great to hear such clarity around delivering this. And also thank you, especially to Matt, for sharing the case references in the chat. So if we could just take 5 minutes, I'll go and grab a cup of tea, and then when we get back, in this time, if you can think of some questions that you'd like to ask Matt or Julia, and just place them in the chat, and then we'll try and distribute the questions appropriately when we get back in 5. Thank you all very much for your attention. Cheers. You two all right to take a break?
Yeah, I'm going to try and put my case references in, although I've given them, let me type them up now.
That's great, Julia. Thank you so much. Really helpful.
JR proportion. I'm just reading the questions. Judicial review. I'll have a word with Matt about that. JR proportionality ground in an immigration context. Yeah.
Great. Shall we? I was just reading the judgment you shared, Matt, on the Child Poverty Action Group and Lead Aid Test there. It's very interesting. Great. Shall we attempt to re-engage with some questions?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I thought that what might be quite good, Aid and Julia, subject to what you guys think, is in the 20 odd minutes we've got available is to answer some of the questions, the very good questions that have been asked on the chat function, but also to just talk about some practical tips for drafting grounds, because I think this is something which is really important to get right when you're actually sitting down to think about, you know, how are you going to formulate your grounds, firstly in a pre-action letter, and secondly when it comes to the statement of facts and grounds. So, I mean, Julia, I'm happy to pick up perhaps first. I'll pick up the good question which has been asked of me about the interaction between Article 6 and the perception of fairness. And I think what is meant by perception of fairness is when I was talking about apparent bias. So the idea that justice must not only be done, it must be seen to be done. And if there is a perception of bias in the decision maker, then this renders the decision unlawful. How does this interact with Article 6? Well, I think the answer to that is that it plainly is part of the right to a fair trial in Article 6, that there needs to be an impartial decision maker. There have been a lot of Strasbourg cases which have looked at the need to have an impartial decision maker to give off the appearance of fairness and justice being seen to be done. But as to what does Article 6 bring to the concept of bias in domestic law, my answer would be probably not a huge amount. And the reason for that is that there is already a pre-existing, very established line of cases in domestic law based on the common law about the importance of avoiding bias in decision making. Porter and McGill is the obvious case, the one I referred to, where the test for apparent bias is set out. And that was a decision which was reached without any regard being paid to the Strasbourg context and the European Convention. And all the European Convention does is offer a parallel protection to what is already present in the domestic context. So I don't think necessarily that Article 6 has a lot to add to what is already there domestically. Although I'd be very interested in hearing examples from any of the participants about Article 6 having more of a role than what I've said. Julia, do you want to pick up any of the questions that have been asked to you about irrationality and proportionality? And you're on mute at the moment.
Thank you. Always going to do that at one point. Thanks very much, Matt. Yes, I will talk about that. And I see there's a question about public sector equality duty challenges as well, which we can both address. I've been arguing about the public sector equality duty a lot lately. So very interesting question from George. An example of a JR proportionality ground in an immigration context, and would it be wrong to say that Wensbury has very slightly lowered the irrationality threshold from an immigration perspective? Well, the first thing to say is in the olden days, before the amendments made by the Immigration Act, we were always arguing about this in a judicial review because there wasn't necessarily a right of appeal. So the only remedy was to go off and argue about it in judicial review. But once the appeal rights were amended in the immigration context, there is now a right of appeal if you're arguing that the decision breaches your human rights. So it's going to be quite unusual to have that direct argument in an immigration context in the JR. Two examples that I thought of. One is the immigration context, but it isn't actually an immigration case, and that's the recent decision of the Court of Appeal in the JCWI case, which was about the landlord checks. And that is worth a read, but so it's in the immigration context, but it's a systemic challenge. And the second example is I suppose if you had a challenge, for example, that a particular system was unfair, for example, that there's been case law about asylum or trafficking support, that would be an immigration context, but it isn't a direct challenge by an individual. So I don't know if that answers the question, and whether Matt, you wanted to come in at that point to see if you've had any examples. I was trying to look through all of my cases to see if I could find something. But as I say, if it does happen, it will be much less frequent now, and it's more likely to be a systemic challenge like that. Does that answer the question? And I'll let Matt come in first, because perhaps he can answer it.
No, I think that's pretty much what I was thinking as well, Julia. I mean, there's a case which I haven't got the reference in front of me, but it's called Lausikas, L-A-U-Z-I-K-A-S, And it's looking at the detention of EEA nationals for under immigration powers, and the proportion and whether the proportionality test applies to their detention pending removal under the EEA regulations. So it might be worth having a look at the, I think it was initially in the High Court in front of Michael Fordham when he was still a deputy, and then it's been considered more recently by the Court of Appeal. I'll try and dig out the reference and send it round. But I've also noticed another question which has come up about PSED challenges and whether and how they'd be formulated. I think it's a really another good question, because it is obviously a ground of challenge. You could say there's been a breach of Section 149 of the Equality Act 2010. There's been a bunch of legislation a bunch of cases that have looked at how to formulate claims like that. And I think that one of the things I would emphasize in terms of dealing with PSED type claims is that you need to be very specific in identifying what way in which the duty has been breached. Too often you see cases where they just say, well, there's been a failure to carry out an equality impact assessment, but without actually saying which particular protected group hasn't been, what's the actual prejudice of the failure? There needs to be an identification of which group has been adversely affected by the way in which either the an equality impact assessment hasn't been carried out at all, or it's been carried out, but it's failed to address a particular group or factor in a particular aspect of the proposal and the effect that's going to have. So that's what I would suggest in terms of PSED challenges. Julia, over to you. Do you want to pick up any other points that have arisen?
In terms of public sector equality duty, I completely agree, and it's a difficult ground for a claimant to make out, but absolutely not impossible, particularly if you're focused and if you focus on the actual test. It can be done. And then in terms of, I've been asked to be more specific on the proportionality ground matter, how would you draft it? And I think that rather depends on what the issue is in the case. I think it's impossible to say, but I wouldn't in grounds be saying it's arguable that the Secretary of State's decision is not proportionate, assuming that was a point that you could properly advance. I would be just saying it's not. But I think in an immigration case, you would need to be absolutely clear about why you were advancing that ground and why the person didn't have an alternative remedy by way of a statutory appeal. So that's something that I would want to explain. But as I said, that will be very, very context specific.
Yeah. I've just put out for everyone the Lozicus case, which I mentioned on the chat. And I thought maybe this, just in terms of picking up that question, Julia, on how would you draft something, that kind of flows onto what I was thinking we might talk about now, which is some of the practical tips about actually formulating claims for JR. Because, I mean, I've got a couple which I'll share, and then Julia, if you've got any to add, then that would be great. I mean, I think the first and possibly most important piece of advice I would give on drafting grounds is be selective. There will be occasional cases where lots of different grounds of challenge arise and apply, but they're usually quite rare. Typically, there might be 2, 3, maybe 4 grounds which are actually standalone, discrete grounds of challenge. So it's worth just really thinking about what is your complaint about this case, and which of the categories of ground does this fall most effectively into. One of the things that frustrates judges, and you see it in hearings, is they kind of interrogate your grounds and say, this ground isn't actually properly formulated. This ground doesn't actually capture what your complaint is. Your complaint isn't that, for example, it's irrational. You're instead complaining about the failure to give adequate reasons. And judges will often do that. They'll kind of say, well, isn't your claim better characterized like this? And so I think that really underlines how important it is to think very carefully at the beginning. What is my ground, and how does it slot in? And the other question which judges like asking is, what does this ground add to ground one? So you might have ground one, you might have ground two that are standalone, but then there might be a third ground, which to be honest, is probably just another way of putting ground one. And judges will say, you know, does this really add anything? Because ultimately judges are looking to write their judgment, and they're looking for a way of doing that that doesn't involve them in spending an awful lot of time on a ground which doesn't have any standalone basis for it. It really is parasitic upon another ground. So it's worth thinking again when you're drafting, what am I adding? Does this have any life of its own? Once, if I lose on ground one, am I going to win on ground three or ground four, or is it really just the same point that I'm making in a different way? So they're probably the two points. Firstly, be selective, and secondly, be clear at the outset about what your ground actually is, rather than fudging it and saying the decision is irrational and or illegal and or disproportionate. Because it just doesn't help the judge in pigeonholing what your precise complaint actually is. Julia, do you want to pick up anything about that?
Well, I think just to emphasise that, and I too have seen judges get very frustrated when I've been on the other side and saying, but what is this ground? Are you actually saying X? Do you mean Y? That's not actually fetter of discretion, is it? It's this instead. And in that Christian Concern case, I gave the example, they run through a series of grounds. Actually, it's quite interesting just seeing how the grounds were argued. But I completely agree with Matt, and I think it really is worth doing that work at the beginning. It's completely different when you're acting for a claimant than when you're acting for the Secretary of State. The claimant absolutely has to do all of the work at the beginning. The Secretary of State, it's relatively easy at the start because the Secretary of State only has to put in summary grounds. But for the claimant, it's really important to be absolutely clear, to marshal your evidence, to develop your theory of the case and get the evidence to support it, so that what you present is a comprehensive case at the beginning, because your next chance to do something in reality will be the skeleton argument, unless you're putting in extra evidence or amending your grounds. But much better to really get the case by the scruff of the neck at the beginning. Really just look at what your complaint is. As Matt said, be selective, pick the right grounds, set them out well, accept that there's no, you know, that sometimes the description of the grounds isn't always consistent between judges, but make sure you're clear about what you mean, and then set that out clearly and stick to it.
Yeah, and I think that's all completely right. And that's not to say that, you know, when you were first formulating your claim, whether it's in a pre-action letter or in the grounds, you might not necessarily be clear at that stage, because you might be lacking in some disclosure from the defendant. So you can say, you can be quite candid about that in your statement of facts and grounds. You can say, on the basis of the information that is currently available to the claimant's advisors, it appears that the appropriate ground of challenge is X, and that means that you are protected if subsequent disclosure means that actually you shouldn't be formulating this as a breach of the duty to give reasons, but instead you should be saying that the reasons are irrational. Then you've left open a clear avenue for you to apply your claim. And it's very important that if you are reformulating your grounds in the life of the claim, which does sometimes happen. Sometimes you might get a summary grounds from the defendant, which says, this is hopeless, or your claim is better formulated in this way, rather than just leave those sorts of things to the skeleton argument or leave them even to the hearing and argue it on that alternative basis. If the defendant's pointing out that you failed to formulate your ground in the correct way and pointed out how you should have done it, then make an application. So it's very difficult for a defendant to resist something like that if it's done at an opportune moment early on in the proceedings. Much better to do that than try and change your ground at the hearing or even in the skeleton argument without having applied formally to do so. So I think that's a really good point to bear in mind. I've also seen there's been a question asked about explaining the difference between failing to take into account relevant considerations and how this is different from a rationality ground. And I think my answer to that would be that they're slightly different in that you can bring an irrationality claim even if you accept that all of the relevant considerations were taken into account. So you can say the decision maker took into account all the relevant considerations, but the decision they reached on the basis of those considerations was irrational. And that's different from saying the decision you reached did not take into account all of the relevant considerations. So can you see how that's slightly separate? It's a separate point to make. One is saying you didn't take into account this factor. The other is saying you took into account all the factors, fair enough, but the decision you actually reached once you went through that process is irrational.
And it may be me that confused that by saying that sometimes a rationality argument is run as a failure to take into account a relevant consideration, which it is, and that's one of the points that's made in De Smith. Or, for example, if you've given a particular consideration manifestly inappropriate weight, that might come in as a rationality challenge as well. And the other point to make about what Matt quite rightly says about amending is that you'll also be expected to look at the disclosure that you get and also drop some of your grounds as well. So it's really, you know, taking that case by the scruff of the neck at every stage, actually. And the more that you've done that up front, the better position you are to do that. But absolutely right, as Matt says, I completely agree. You often won't have the information. And that, in my experience, often in the big systemic challenges, the claimant has got the information because they're running the challenge and it's their evidence. But again, that can also vary because disclosure is given, or if disclosure is given late, that might cause the theory of the case to change. The other point to come back on as well is Matt mentioned Lausicus. In terms of EU proportionality, there's case law at the moment about, or there's litigation at the moment about removal before appeal in an EU context that I've been involved in, and that also is looking at proportionality very directly, and that's EU proportionality, and I can also add that to the case references once I do them, if that would help.
I've just stuck in a quick reference to a case called Wingfield, which, for anyone who's, I mean, it's probably the sort of case which defendants will rely on. So if anyone's representing defendants at any point, then this is quite a good case to rely on if the claimant is developing their case in their skeleton without having applied formally for permission to rely on a different ground or a changed ground. This was a case where Mrs. Justice Lang came down very hard on a claimant who just decided, they actually did a reply. They did a reply to the summary grounds where they reformulated a new ground. And the judge said, that's completely unacceptable. You can't do that in a reply. The reply should only be dealing with the grounds as you've got them at that stage and responding to points in the summary grounds or the detailed grounds. So it's quite a useful case for relying on if you want to shoot down an attempt to enlarge or expand a case as it evolves over the lifetime of the hearing and proceedings.
And actually that reminds me of a point, Matt, just to add to that if you're pleading a claim for damages, it's absolutely crucial that you set that out properly. And there's a judgment of the Court of Appeal on that. I think it's a case called Fayyad. It's a decision of Lord Justice Singh. Again, I'll put that in the notes, because that's the case I've relied on recently to say, look, you can't just say I want damages without explaining the actual cause of action and then actually breaking down what you're entitled to damages for. So if you are going to plead a claim for damages, then you need to set that out.
Yeah. Well, it's 12:30. I'm conscious that we've prevailed upon your engagement for the last 90 minutes. And I expect everyone's hungry. Hey, do you want to say any finishing words here?
Just once again to thank Matt and Julia, and also for the case notes you've been sticking into the chat. If there's anything else you want us to follow up on, then please do send it by email, and Amelie and myself go and circulate that to everyone. Just in the middle of that, I kind of rather rudely interrupted the chat with a plug for the next big PLP event, because you happened to mention the public sector equality duty. Well, PLP are organising a week of events from the 23rd to the 28th of July. We should publicise the whole event this week, but it's a series of seminars and effectively a conference spread over a week on celebrating 10 years of protections from the Equalities Act 2010. So many questions that you might have about the Equalities Act, its application, and the PSED, hopefully we'll get answered in that focused event there. Otherwise, thank you all for joining us, and I hope you have a good rest of the day. And I think the next event this afternoon or tomorrow, I'm not sure actually, in this series. I should know that. We've got something in front of you, or you'll find the programme on PLP's website. Thank you all again for listening and being patient, and also for your excellent questions and engagement. And I'm going to close down the meeting. Thank you, Julia and Matt.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Oh, they all disappeared. Wow. That was great, Julia. Thank you.
That's Matt gone. Thank you. I'm going to just put those cases together. And I'll send that over. I'll just do that now.
Great. Thanks, Julia.
All right. Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you.
That was really great attendance today. I mean, really, we've been bowled over with, we thought there'd be, but basically charging the same amount for online training as we did for in-person training. But actually, people seem to enjoy spreading it out over the week.
Yeah.
This quite structured interaction as well, which is really good.
It's quite good, isn't it? Always, it's funny, isn't it? These things have advantages, you know, doing things by webinar. So that's good. And no, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for letting me take part, and hopefully next time as well.
Indeed. Right.
Thanks very much. Have a lovely afternoon.
You too. Hope you get some sun.
Hot. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.